I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's March 29th, and we have a lot to talk about. And one of the things we're talking about today is the impact that the International Progressive MS Alliance has had on elevating the progressive MS research agenda and moving it forward. A few weeks ago, the Alliance announced the details of an ambitious strategic plan that will guide their work over the next 3 years. Joining me to talk about what that means for people affected by progressive MS is the chair of the Alliance's Scientific Steering Committee, Dr. Robert Fox. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Fox, there are a few other things that you should know about. Last year, the MS International Federation distributed a survey asking people affected by MS and healthcare professionals to set the research priorities for the Cochrane MS and Rare Diseases of the Central Nervous System Group. Now, Cochrane is an international nonprofit organization that generates evidence-based research reviews so that people can make informed decisions about the health issues that they may be facing. Now, this survey was translated into 12 languages, and 1,190 responses were received from 55 different countries. 75% of the responses came from people living with MS, while the balance of the survey responses came from family members and healthcare professionals. The results of the survey produced 5 priority research questions. The Cochrane Group will survey the published research to provide consensus evidence that attempts to answer each of these questions. And the 5 priority research questions are: does MRI help predict disability worsening in people with MS? What are the benefits and harms of treating people with MS with one disease-modifying drug compared to another? Does psychological health affect disease progression in MS? Does multidisciplinary care by teams of different social and health professionals improve health outcomes and experiences for people with MS? And what are the benefits and harms of exercise for people with MS? As I reviewed these research priorities, a few things came to mind. First, I was glad to see that people with MS are curious about whether exercise is beneficial for them, or how their emotional well-being might influence their disease course, or if they might experience a better outcome if they were being treated by a multidisciplinary team of specialists. The next thing that came to mind was that these questions have been answered. The evidence is there, and it's conclusive. But it seems that there are still large parts of the global MS community who don't know that. And perhaps that's a larger issue that's being uncovered through these survey results. It isn't always a question of whether more research needs to be done. It sometimes becomes a question of making research results more accessible. Finding ways to communicate research results in language that people affected by MS can easily understand. Now, I'm not arguing against publishing research in peer-reviewed journals. Of course, that's necessary and important. But you can't expect people without a science background to navigate their way through the articles published in these journals if they can find them. We need to take additional steps to ensure that MS research results are accessible and understandable to non-scientists. We know that shared decision-making between a patient and their neurologist can lead to better outcomes. Being a partner in your own treatment is empowering, and shared decision-making makes it more likely that someone will adhere to their treatment plan. But shared decision-making requires that the patient has done their homework so that they can fully understand what their doctor is recommending and they can share their opinion with their doctor. In other words, shared decision-making starts by being well-informed. And if we don't want patients to limit their research to scrolling through random social media posts, then we need to find ways to simplify their access to credible, reliable, evidence-based information. I'd be missing an obvious point here if I didn't mention that this is the whole reason that I started this podcast. And while I'm happy to be doing my part, this isn't something that gets solved with a single podcast. So I hope that we can begin having that larger conversation to identify ways to share research results with a larger, non-scientific, but nonetheless heavily invested audience. One of the topics that comes up frequently on this podcast is depression. And the reason we tend to talk about depression is because one out of every two people with MS will experience clinical depression, and there are things you can do to fix it. Depression may be prevalent among people living with MS, but depression can be effectively treated. And results from a study in Australia may give you one more evidence-based, non-pharmaceutical way to manage depression. A research team at the University of Sydney created an 8-week online mindfulness program for people living with MS. The program consisted of 5 modules, including an introduction to mindfulness management and simple awareness, dealing with stress, dealing with difficult emotions and pain, dealing with thoughts, and mindful communication, compassion, and relapse prevention. Each module was about 15 to 20 minutes long and included examples of how mindfulness techniques could be applied to life with MS. To determine their program's effectiveness, the research team recruited 132 adult men and women who were living with MS. Each study participant was randomly assigned to either the mindfulness program or no intervention at all. Instead, this group was told they were on a waiting list. Study participants watched the online modules and completed 30 minutes of individual mindfulness meditation. They also kept a log to track their activities, and they had a weekly group call with a psychologist who offered guidance, resolved any technical issues they were having, and encouraged their ongoing participation. At the end of 8 weeks, the study participants who were given the mindfulness program reported a significant lessening in depression compared with those study participants who were on the so-called waiting list. People with a history of recurrent depression showed a significantly greater benefit, and health-related quality of life significantly improved for those study participants who were given the mindfulness program, regardless of their individual history of depression. These benefits were maintained 6 months after the study when the participants were evaluated again, and those study participants who were on that wait list were given access to the mindfulness program as well. Being able to mitigate the effects of depression without yet another prescription drug and from the comfort and convenience of your own home represents a major step forward in managing one of those MS symptoms that can get in the way of everything and keep you from fully engaging in your own life. So we'll be looking for larger studies that will hopefully achieve similar outcomes. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. From the file labeled Often Overlooked Details of Living with MS, people with relapsing MS tend to see their olfactory threshold worsen during a relapse. In more simple terms, that olfactory threshold is your sense of smell. And it seems that your sense of smell gets measurably worse during a period of active inflammation in the brain, but it isn't affected during periods of stable disease. And this can be very useful information when it comes to evaluating whether a particular disease-modifying therapy is working for someone. We all know that different disease-modifying therapies work differently for each person, and the DMT that's effective for one person may not be as effective for someone else. So a research team in Austria wanted to use this worsening of olfactory threshold as a biomarker for evaluating the effectiveness of any disease-modifying therapy. So they recruited 123 people with relapsing MS who were starting on a new disease-modifying therapy for the first time. The study participants had their sense of smell assessed at the start of the study, after 3 months, and after 1 year. It's worth noting that over the course of the study, slightly less than half of the 123 participants had an MS relapse, and their OT, their olfactory threshold, was significantly lower than it was prior to their relapse. A statistical analysis of the three assessments showed that the OT score, that is, the measurement of each study participant's sense of smell, could significantly differentiate each person's relapse risk. And the research team noted that a change in the OT score over the study's first 3 months was significantly predictive of the risk of relapsing. The researchers were able to correlate the scores of the three smell tests with brain lesions, clinical activity, and disability progression. The key to tailoring MS treatment to each individual is being able to understand how that individual will respond to any specific disease-modifying therapy. This small study demonstrated that OT, olfactory threshold, is a valid predictor of someone's response to a DMT. The research team cautioned that this was a relatively small study, and further research is required to validate their findings. But it's encouraging to see that a simple, non-invasive test could perhaps let you and your neurologist know in fairly short order whether a particular disease-modifying therapy is the right disease-modifying therapy for you. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. We often hear that there's a genetic component to MS, although it's not yet fully understood. So researchers at the Rocky Mountain MS Center at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus are trying to, if not understand, at least be able to better predict how that genetic component might manifest itself. We know that parents, children, and siblings of people with MS have an increased risk of developing MS themselves. And we also know that MS seems to be the result of certain genes interacting with certain environmental factors. Scientists have already identified about 235 genetic changes that are associated with MS, along with a number of environmental factors, including low vitamin D levels, living in northern latitudes, and having a history of Epstein-Barr virus infection. Beyond expertise in multiple sclerosis, this multidisciplinary team at the University of Colorado includes experts in epidemiology, genetics, and biomedical informatics. And in this study, they begin by conducting an MRI exam of the parents, children, and siblings of someone living with MS to determine whether any plaques or lesions can be identified in the brain. Then they take this MRI-positive group and they begin creating a composite risk of MS score by analyzing other risk factors. These risk factors include both genetic and environmental risks. Creating this standardized risk of MS score allows the team to intervene with those participants who seem highly likely to develop MS symptoms before they actually experience those symptoms, and guiding these individuals through lifestyle changes and proactively providing high-efficacy disease-modifying therapy could mean that these individuals might never develop symptomatic MS. Now, this is very early work, but it's another step toward that game-changing moment when this early risk assessment means that someone never experiences a single MS symptom. It may not be a cure, but it may feel like one. There's lots of work ahead, but this is the kind of study that could lead to breakthrough results. You can be sure I'll be updating you on the progress this team is making. Biopharmaceutical company Neurogenesis announced promising results of a small clinical trial demonstrating its personalized NG01 cell therapy as a potential treatment for progressive MS. The Neurogenesis technology involves collecting bone marrow from the patient. Specific stem cells are gathered from the bone marrow and enhanced in the lab so that they can promote brain repair. Then the stem cells are injected into the patient's central nervous system, where they regenerate and repair damaged areas in the brain. This clinical trial was designed to compare the outcomes of reintroducing these stem cells intravenously or by injecting them directly into the spinal fluid, and the trial showed that direct injection into the spinal fluid produced very promising results. Of the 15 study participants with progressive MS who received spinal injections, 9 experienced a decrease in levels of neurofilament light chain. We've talked about neurofilament light chain before on the podcast. It's a protein that can be measured in the blood, and it's been shown that neurofilament light chain levels increase as MS disability progresses. Of the 9 study participants who experienced a decrease in their levels of neurofilament light chain, 8 showed lessening of disability as measured by improved EDSS scores. EDSS, or the Expanded Disability Status Scale, is the standardized way that neurologists measure disability and track MS progression. And the improvement in disability among these 8 study participants was still evident a year later when the study ended. When you think about the fundamental differences between the neurogenesis NG01 cell therapy and other disease-modifying therapies, the neurogenesis treatment enables the brain to actually repair itself instead of just slowing the rate of progression. This is another example of science bringing us closer to the goal of repair. And repair restores lost function. Neurogenesis plans to begin a larger phase 2 clinical trial of their NG01 cell therapy toward the end of this year. In the meantime, if you'd like to check out the results of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. The International Progressive MS Alliance has played an important role in making progressive MS research part of the broader MS research agenda. Recently, the Alliance adopted an ambitious strategic plan that will guide their work over the next 3 years. In a moment, my guest, Dr. Robert Fox, the chair of the Alliance Scientific Steering Committee, will share some of the details of that plan and explain what it means for people affected by progressive MS. For people living with relapsing remitting MS, treatment is typically focused on preventing and managing relapses. But if you're living with progressive MS, relapses are uncommon and there are no remissions. Instead, you're faced with a slow, gradual worsening of your symptoms. Addressing the needs of people with progressive MS remains a central challenge for researchers and clinicians, and while there's been considerable progress in understanding progressive MS, there's still a lot to learn. Joining me to increase our understanding of progressive MS is Dr. Robert Fox. Dr. Fox is a neurologist at the Cleveland Clinic's Mellon Center for Multiple Sclerosis Treatment and Research and the vice chair for research at the Cleveland Clinic Neurological Institute. He's also a professor of neurology at the Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine. And full disclosure, Dr. Fox and I know each other through my recently completed term as a member of the International Progressive MS Alliance Scientific Steering Committee, which Dr. Fox now chairs. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Fox.
It's great to be with you again, John.
I'm hoping you can get us started by walking us through the differences between relapsing remitting MS and progressive MS.
Well, the name belies the secret, and you described it at the top of this segment. Relapsing MS is heralded by the clinical relapses, which are episodes of numbness, weakness, blurry vision, double vision. They come on over several hours to several days, perhaps even evolving over a week or so, and then gradually improve over a couple weeks to a month or so. Those are the relapses, and they represent new areas of inflammation, new focuses of inflammatory cells in the brain and the spinal cord. In contrast, progressive MS is manifest primarily by gradual, little by little worsening, most commonly worsening in walking, although gradual, little by little worsening in arm function and thinking, memory, multitasking, concentration, things like that are also seen and reported in people with progressive MS. And it's important to realize that these are not two exclusive forms of the disease. There is overlap. So relapses can be seen in patients with progressive MS. And a little bit of progression can be seen in patients in the middle of their relapsing remitting stage as well.
Do we know what drives progression in MS?
We really don't at this point, if we're truly honest. We know what drives the relapsing MS. So at least we think we know. The peripheral immune system, meaning the white blood cells going through the bloodstream, leave the bloodstream and go into the brain and the spinal cord and the optic nerve and attack it in pockets. In progressive MS, it doesn't appear that that is what's going on at all. Instead, there is something different. That something different may be a metabolic derangement, meaning the metabolism of the neurons and the axons within the brain are being overly stressed or somehow deranged. There may be disruption of the supporting cells within the brain. They're called microglia and astrocytes. These are the supporting cells within the brain and the spinal cord that support the axons and the neurons. There can be compartmentalized, meaning contained within the brain and the spinal cord, inflammation that drives on the progression of progressive MS. So there's a couple different things that we think may be driving progression, but we don't really know which it is.
We often hear MS described as a progressive disease. Now, does this mean that everyone currently living with relapsing MS will transition one day to secondary progressive MS?
This is a very important question, and the short answer is no. We think if we can diagnose relapsing MS early enough, start treatment early, monitor response to ensure patients are responding to the current therapy sufficiently, and change treatment if we need to, that we can decrease the proportion of patients or delay the progression by many, many years. So we think we are able to prevent the evolution of relapsing MS into progressive MS. So no, we don't think all patients will eventually evolve into progressive MS.
There's increasing evidence that shows that adopting a general wellness program can improve the quality of life for people living with MS. What types of healthy behaviors are important, and how does adopting these behaviors impact someone's MS progression?
We do think that there are several things in the healthy lifestyle category that can help slow progression in progressive MS. We know that treating other medical conditions like diabetes and high blood pressure or hypertension, also being overweight, we think treating these conditions slow the progression of progressive MS. We also think that routine exercise can help with progressive MS, and things as simple as, although it can be difficult, smoking cessation. So smoking is associated with accelerated progression of progressive MS, and patients who then stop smoking do have a slowed rate of progression. Now, sometimes patients will say, hey, doc, I'm not able to walk anymore for my MS. How can I do exercise? Well, patients can still do exercise. It needs to be adapted to whatever their abilities are. But most patients are still able to do some sort of aerobic exercise. For example, an exercise bike wheel that the arms can run on a tabletop. So just because a patient can't walk doesn't mean they have an excuse not to engage in some level of routine exercise.
When I first introduced you, I mentioned you were the chair of the International Progressive MS Alliance Scientific Steering Committee. Since some of our listeners may not be as familiar with the Alliance as you and I, can you explain what the International Progressive MS Alliance is and what role the Scientific Steering Committee plays?
Sure. The International Progressive MS Alliance, or the Alliance as we call it, is a global collaboration with a goal of accelerating the development of effective therapies for people with progressive MS. A rather tall task, but nonetheless, with the goal then of improving quality of life worldwide for people living with progressive MS. It's comprised of MS organizations, researchers, health professionals, the pharmaceutical industry, companies, trusts, foundations, donors, and people affected by progressive MS. People all over in different aspects that touch progressive MS are involved and come together to address the unmet needs of people with progressive MS. We even have involvement of the pharmaceutical industry, where they partner with the Alliance through the industry forum to help us find solutions for progressive MS.
The Progressive MS Alliance really represents a first-of-its-kind global response to solving progressive MS. And to that end, the Alliance just recently published a strategic plan designed to guide its work over the next 3 years through the year 2025. Now, the plan begins by first very succinctly stating the vision of the Alliance to end MS progression. And then it identifies three priorities that will drive the Alliance research agenda: to understand, prevent, and reverse MS progression, to speed up and improve clinical trials, and to improve well-being through proven therapeutic approaches. These are big goals. Can you tell us about them?
Yeah, so these goals were identified as the major stumbling blocks that have been keeping us from developing effective therapies for progressive MS. It's understanding the mechanisms that drive progression, which will then point to potential therapeutic modalities or the avenues of treatment to then test. Speeding up clinical trials, so accelerating clinical trials, identifying better outcomes for early stage proof of concept trials so that we can quickly identify potentially effective therapies and speed them along into larger trials to understand whether they work or not. And then improving well-being and addressing the different symptoms that people living with progressive MS have and figuring out the best strategies to measure those symptoms and measure the impact of treatments to address those symptoms. The Scientific Steering Committee is the heart and soul of the Alliance, and it is the group that then takes those quite lofty goals and identifies the step-by-step processes that we should follow to then achieve those goals.
Well, Dr. Robert Fox, I want to thank you for all you do to improve the lives of people living with MS, and thanks for talking with me today.
It's a pleasure joining you, John. Happy to see you again in the future.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/239. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.